Hey, good morning. We could maybe sort of do a roll call here and see if everybody's here and can hear us and has joined the Bridget session and so on. Folks in Wolf Creek, how are you this morning?
We are doing great here in Wolf Creek this morning.
Sounds like yesterday was a rough day for you.
Better at resets now.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. Maybe if we just to start, Wolf Creek, can you give me sort of a synopsis of what we got out of yesterday's session?
Firefox won't start.
Well, for some of us here, it was some new exposure to working with blogs. It was new for a couple of people here. Some other members, they've had quite a bit of experience with working with blogs. And now we're hoping that we can look more at how we, at our implementation, or both the ideas about whether or not we use the specific tools, but how we can use them effectively with our students.
Okay, great. Sort of open question here. Did that question or that issue of application and implementation and use within our schools get discussed yesterday?
It did in the afternoon, yeah.
Okay.
He touched on it for a while there.
All right. I know yesterday morning when we started, I asked everyone what they would like to get out of that day's session. Maybe we'll sort of ask you the same sort of question here. Are there specific topics that you touched on yesterday during your discussion on implementation that you would like to pursue a little further here this morning?
Well, for us specifically, our group was comprised mainly of people looking at teaching in a video conference environment and the blended learning environment, so using these technologies as an asynchronous support. And so what... it's not who's talking. that's what we'd like to do in talking amongst ourselves, is looking at... providing that asynchronous support in that environment, and whether it's using our first class to do that, or if it's using one of the other tools, that's what we have to take some time exploring.
Okay, and I'm not sure here again. You know, I really dreaded the fact that I had to leave here yesterday, but what I think we should look at when we're considering these technologies is that the technologies are composed of tools, and they're also composed of processes that those tools facilitate. And I think maybe we have to look at them from maybe that process kind of perspective and say, what is it that we really want to do and accomplish, and then what tool set can we use to accomplish that? In black gold there, Peter, you get sort of a synopsis of what you got out of yesterday's session.
We very much started to focus on using these tools in terms of collaboration, which is something we really wanted to work more on. Collaboration amongst teachers, but also collaboration between students within a class and outside of class, between various sites, to support some of the things we're doing between the schools. So really, as you were saying, Gord, looking at the process of that, we're very interested. Stephen showed us some tools yesterday that we got very excited about, and we're interested in looking more in terms of the use of those tools.
Okay. I think the little bit of time that I was here yesterday, you know, I noticed when we explore the tools, we always say, I can, or you could, or, you know, this is what this will do for you. And you talk in terms of can and could, and we're not having, or maybe you did talk a little bit about the would or should use within our classroom setting. Again, maybe what I'd kind of like to take some time and have you think about as we're going through this morning's session is maybe a follow-up to the discussion we had this yesterday afternoon, looking at what specific technologies, tools, and processes can we pull out of what we did yesterday that could be used in a K-12 setting. And also maybe, you know, sort of separate from that, take a look at what we could do in a professional development kind of setting with our staffs, with our teaching staffs, our support staffs, and that sort of thing as well. And if you sort of keep that in the back of your mind here, I'd kind of like to sort of turn it over to Stephen at this point to sort of give us a gist of what you'd like to do for the first little bit. And then I want to maybe take some time and, you know, after Stephen's gone through a few examples here, to maybe break out again and look at those couple of questions again here, if we could. Okay.
Okay. Well, again, just so that everyone knows, I've got the audio recorder on, and I do have the audio from yesterday up on my website. Just got it uploaded this morning. For those of you who are listening on audio, that was Gordon Booth who introduced the session. He's from Grand Yellowhead School Division. I always have two audiences when I do this. What I've done is I've gathered up a few things that I didn't cover yesterday that I would like to cover. And I've also gathered up a bunch of examples of uses of this sorts of technology in different websites, different schools, and that around the world. If you hop onto my homepage, that's at downs.ca, and I'm just going to put it up on the screen here. Are you guys hearing me okay in the remote sites, or should I be speaking louder?
Good. You're good here in Wolf Creek.
Excellent. And okay, so click on the research link. Now, I didn't gather this yesterday. this is actually a list of all the resources that I've compiled over roughly 5 years or so, 6 years or so of blogging. And so the various topics, publications, and authors. That's not what I wanted to show you. This is just a way station, but I just thought I'd linger on it for a second. I'm hoping it's displaying okay on yours. No?
No.
Okay. You guys are using Internet Explorer. Internet Explorer's understanding of CSS is, well, shall we say, idiosyncratic. It works really well in Firefox. I'll redo this page so it displays nice, or you can use Firefox. Anyhow, happily we're not using this page, so it doesn't matter. But you should see a link near the top that says Downs Wiki. If you just pop onto that, this is my scratch pad. And basically it's a personal wiki. And I've set this up so that you have to be logged in order to change it. And that's because I got all kinds of Chinese advertising on it. Which, in addition to being incomprehensible, is really annoying. If you click, it's about the fifth link down, it says samples. And that's what I've got set up for today. I just took some notes from the opening session, from Gord's introduction there. I put those at the top just to give us an outline for a focus for our discussion. This is what I really like about using the wikis. I can come up with an outline on the fly like this. It's just so easy to edit and to make available. So the major things I've got on the go today, some of the things that I missed, social bookmarking, a few sites, to-do lists. I would like to talk a wee bit about Skype. If I had really been thinking several months ago, I would have asked for Skype to be installed on your computers as well. I don't know if Skype will work in your school networks or whether it would be blocked, but I find it an enormously useful tool. What made me think of it, I was sitting in my hotel room, not last night, the night before, just sort of puttering around getting ready for this thing, and I had Skype on as usual. and up pops a request from Rob Wall. Rob does a podcast, which I'll introduce in a little bit. And so we just did a Skype interview for his podcast just on the fly. And then they were done, and I went back to doing what I was doing, and now they're off editing their Skype podcast. Anyhow, below those things, I've dug up a bunch of examples of how this technology is used in a school environment. I tried to focus on K-12 schools, although there's a little bit of post-secondary in there. And so, and this is a small sampling. This is just the tiniest tip of the iceberg of what's out there. A lot of these things are being widely used in a wide variety of circumstances. So I'm not sure where you want to go first, if you would like me to look at some of these things, or if you would like to look at the examples first. And at some point during the day as well, I want to linger a little bit, not for too long, but talk a little bit about some of the theory underlying the use of these applications. There's a number of people have done some good and interesting work in the types of learning and the types of pedagogy that are enabled by multi-user networks like this, and that falls under the heading of connectivism. Some work by George Siemens and some work by myself, and I want to draw that out and highlight that because I think it's important, if that's okay. After I say it's important, then I say, is that okay?
This is what we're going to do, whether we like it or not.
Yeah. Well, and again, today is in your hands, and the purpose of the session is for your benefit. So I will be guided by, especially by Gord.
Well, I'm going to be guided by everyone that's here.
Right.
The folks in Black Gold, any preference as to where we start here this morning?
I don't think so. Just go for it.
Okay. Wolf Creek, preferences?
No, let's go for it.
Okay. Folks here? I see thumbs up, you bet.
Thumbs up,
okay.
You bet. And it's early in the morning, and people are awake, so I guess we're ready to go. So you notice how, though, I've neatly delayed the start of this till 9 o'clock. That's about when my brain kicks in. Actually, no, my brain kicks in around 10:30, 11 o'clock, so what you're getting right now is autopilot. But that's okay. All right, well, I've given you some links there. We'll just start off. I do want to touch on social bookmarking because I know that it serves a real need in the school environment. I've clicked on Delicious, and this has spawned a whole bunch of offshoots with the .us extension, but this is probably the most widely used and the most popular. And basically what Delicious is a place to store your bookmarks online. And students find this really useful because traditionally when you're using BookNotes bookmarks or an Internet Explorer favorites, because Microsoft has to have its own name for everything, they're based on the browser, wherever the browser is located. But the bookmarks in Delicious are, of course, online, which means they're accessible not only from school but also from home. So the usual process here, right? So we'll register and fill in your username. Really all you need is a username and a password, but if you want more, you should feel free to put that in. And then we've got the ubiquitous CAPTCHA here. So you have to type in those letters, and they're probably all different for each of you. Now I should still have an account here. The CAPTCHAs? Yeah, they do work. There are some graphics recognition programs out there. And you notice the design of the CAPTCHAs changes all the time. The different backgrounds and that, it really does slow down these automated registration systems. I personally have had a running battle for a number of years with these spammers on my wiki, my comments board. Yesterday during this session, I popped open my comments and deleted a bit of spam because they got through my system.
Kids with special needs.
Well, there is, with the CAPTCHAs, I've noticed some sites also have a link that allows it to read it out in audio. So it reads it out in audio, and then you type back in what you've heard. For the most part, I find requiring user registration does the trick. And I hate user registration with a passion. But, you know, the spammers really have made the open internet a real problem. And that's something to take note of in a school environment especially. Anything that you have open where people from the outside web can contribute will attract spam. And so don't do it because you'll get some really nasty, offensive, vile stuff on your website if people can just contribute stuff. You have to have some kind of barrier. It's just the web is like that these days. Eventually, there will be an identification system that will prevent a lot of this stuff, and there's some work being done on that now. I've been doing some work on it, and if you're curious, you can always look at, if you just want to see where this is going to go in the future, look up YADIS, yet another distributed identity system, or identity, well, they added interoperability. And you notice how they're using a wiki to design the specification. So I'm involved in this. People from LiveJournal are involved in this, TypePad, and some others. I have a working implementation on my own system. I won't go there right now because it's not widely used. Well, it's not used at all except by me. But that's where the future will go, is in this direction. And we're going to see sometime next 12 months or so an internet-wide distributed identification system, and that'll cut back on a lot of this spam. But that's not where I wanted to go, so let's go to Delicious. And we'll see if my login works. And it does. Now, as you see, I don't use Delicious a lot, honestly. But that is only because I have my own system, my own website, and the software I've written myself. But Delicious is very popular. It's very widely used. Now, the neat thing about Delicious, and I'll just see if I can't find it here. The way it works, I'm looking for it. The way it works is you create a bookmark, and I'm just looking for the little bookmark thingy. And here we go. Post your way. Here we go. So I don't know if you saw where I went to get to this link, but from the home page, click on post. And if you want to save a bookmark, you can just post it right here. Just type in whatever you're posting. So I'll type something in. That might work. Government of Canada. And then once you've typed in, you can add a little description. So I'll type in Government of Canada. For now. Now, what I want you to notice, you see that bottom form that says tags? That's kind of like keywords. And basically, you come up with some descriptive words for the site that you're typing in. So I'll type in, for example, Canada. Oh, I don't know what else. That'll probably do. I could add a number of these tags. And what that does is that marks this bookmark as belonging to that word. And now I'll save it. and it's going to take a couple seconds to save here. This is an instance of what is called a folksonomy. And if you looked up on Google folksonomy, you'd find quite a bit of material out there on the web. Because what's happening now is everybody else that's using Delicious, I don't know why it's not saving, it's being slow. Everybody else who's using Delicious is also tagging their links. And they're just picking these keywords out of the air that they think are appropriate for their bookmarks. And what Delicious does is it takes these tags and provides you with a link to everybody who is tagged something the same way. And I'm just getting a blank screen now, which is really annoying.
I'm just going to not even register. I hit the same problem.
Boy, that's annoying.
Yeah. When I did mine, I got added back to some search things, and then I hit the save button. I got the search and like the spyware search site.
Spyware search site. Okay. Well, try to go back to the home page. Let's see if the home page is working. Yeah, the home page seems to be coming up. Now, if you look, take a look, recent and popular, what these links are the tags that people have typed in for their links. So, for example, we have Honda Civic here, which probably makes the people at Honda very happy. I'm not going to go there because that's video, and I don't really want to play a video at the moment. Pinball coffee table. There we go. I like that. Somebody has tagged something, pinball coffee table. Go figure. So we'll click on that, and what this is going to produce, oh, it's going to take us straight there. Well, it's not supposed to do that. But it's a pretty cool thing, though. yeah, it's a pinball coffee table. Okay. Oh, yeah, okay, sorry about that. Yeah, that's the other anti-spam thing, is verify your email.
Well, I haven't gotten my back yet.
Yeah, you can request another one.
Let's click on this thing, popular tags. Now, these are tags. This is what's known as a tag cloud. And what it is, it's a set of tags, typically organized in alphabetical order, and the size of the text indicates how popular that tag is at the moment. Usually it's like day by day or whatever. And when you click on any of these, I'll click on CSS, because that seems pretty safe. Now what we've got is a list of links that have been tagged by people as CSS. And not surprisingly, what we're getting here is a set of associated links on this topic. And then we can follow that up.
The search engines aren't doing anything after you tap into this.
They're beginning to, yes. They are beginning to, because they harvest Delicious, right? And so they harvest Delicious, that gives them the set of links, and then that associates those links to this page. But they don't, obviously they don't rely on it exclusively, so it's kind of a marginal sort of thing. So now this is pretty cool, because now if we go back, I'll go back to my own tags, my bookmarks. I guess the government of Canada never went in. And this is also very interesting. I've got something here. Here's my website, and I've got this one tagged. This one has been linked to by 22 other people here on Delicious. And here are all the people who've linked to the My Glue site. I can look at how they've tagged it. I can follow one of their tags, OPML, for example, and now I'll get the similarity from before. I'll get all of the tags related to OPML. If I'm interested in this person, Alex Byrne, I'll follow this link and see what Alex Byrne is tagging. So what I've done is I've gone from something that I've done to a topic that I'm interested in to somebody who's writing about that topic to what that person writes about. And now I look at the new market bubble theory and Delicious as Feed Manager, all of that stuff, of course. And so it sort of allows me to explore iteratively through the network, layer by layer, by related links. So this is social networking merging with bookmarking or tagging. And what happens is the ontology that results, instead of being one of these top-down ontologies that librarians create, where everything's organized in Dewey Decimal or Library of Congress or whatever, and everything's put into its place, this ontology is created from the bottom up, just by people what people think the subject of this item should be. And it results in very different sorts of classifications. Now, one of the neat things you can do with this, and what is being done more and more, is when you create a new post, what's the URL for the school division? All right, now let's do that at Stephen speed. www.gyrd.ca. All right, I'll save it. And Grand Yellowhead. Now, if we all tag this, we could get Grand Yellowhead right up there in the rankings for a day. That's known as tag spamming. School division. But what you can do now is, now we'll all agree on a tag, and we'll pick a tag that nobody else is likely to use. Well, let's do like say GYRD 2006. Who's going to pick that as a category, right? So now I'll save this. And it might not save because Delicious is being slow this morning. It's in the morning, you know. Yeah. Well, that's one of the risks of these online systems, right? And as an aside, a lot of the development, Web 2.0 has developed in this way with these online services like that. And they get really popular, and then, as you say, they crater. And my feeling has always been that what you want is a localized version of the same thing running on your own server, so that you would have something like this that's specific to your school or your school division or something like that. Now, the code for this is not available, but someone, actually an open source programmer who lives in Moncton called Steve Mallett, has written a script called Delirious. And the URL is, as you might imagine, which is an open source version of this. I wonder if, now I say that not knowing whether it's still up. I don't know how to spell Delirious. I think that's right. It used to be up. I haven't checked it recently, but it's going to be slow. And maybe I spelled it wrong. It would really help if I could spell Delirious. Okay, there's a band called Delirious. I don't want that. Here we go. No. Oh, well, it's out there somewhere. There's an article on it. Oh, yeah, okay, I had it right. It's just not going to answer, that's all.
No.
Anyhow, that's the link for it, and when the site comes up again, you can investigate that. Or you can get some of your students to write up a piece of software that does this in PHP or Perl or whatever. Your students, some of them anyways, could probably do it without too much difficulty. Now, the other thing I want to show about Delicious, I'll go back to it here. Boy, we're really having bandwidth issues, which seems to be, I don't know whether it's the site or who's downloading video.
No, I think it's just Delicious.
Yeah. Now, what you can also do, if you go back to that post link, click on the link here that says browser buttons. And the idea, because it's a real pain to go back to the Delicious website every time you want to post something, right? So you see this down here, drag this link to your bookmarks toolbar. So that's mine. That'll take me to my Delicious site. But even better, drag this link, post to Delicious. I'll just drag it to my bookmarks. There it is. Now I'll go off to some site. Say, Google. And now, post to Delicious, it'll capture the URL. It'll capture the page title. I can just add some notes if I want, but what most people do is just do a couple of tags, and they're away to the races.
You just copy and paste those ones you're below, too.
Yep. Absolutely. That's known generically as a bookmarklet. And what a bookmarklet is a small JavaScript application that you save as a bookmark. And I'm not gonna go in that direction, but there's a whole wide range of bookmarklets that'll do different things for you on your web browser.
There's a blog lines one.
Yeah, there's a whole pile of them. If I go to Google, I'll just type in bookmarklets as a search term, and we see the bookmarklet homepage and more. There is, of course, the ubiquitous Wikipedia article on bookmarklets. Try finding this one in Britannica. And as you can see, well, I guess I got it almost word for word. A bookmarklet is a small JavaScript program that can be stored as a URL within a bookmark in most popular web browsers. So, you can sort of see how a service like Delicious or software that does very much the same thing could have a number of interesting uses in a school environment. You know, for example, you can create a class project where you send people out to search for stuff and everybody just make sure everybody tags what they find using the same tag. Then you come back the next day, open up the page for that tag and see what everybody found. And of course, that list of links, now everybody's gone off and done their research, right? That list of links now can form the basis for a subsequent project, like a blog posting assignment or something like that, or maybe a collaborative class web page on that particular topic. Or if your class wants to be altruistic, the class can combine and get together and create a Wikipedia page on that subject. And a lot of schools do this, where they get the class together and they do their research and they find out all about something to do with their own community, right? They might start off with a Wikipedia page about their own town or a Wikipedia page about the Legion in their own town and what the people from that Legion have done and write that up. And that's great content for Wikipedia. And the people at Wikipedia just love it because this is the difference between something like Wikipedia and Britannica is you can do things in Wikipedia that are of very local interest, but it's still good information, it's still encyclopedic information, and it makes that tool more useful for people because if they're searching your community, they find out, you know, they find not just, you know, the home page put up by the town council or whatever, but they find these articles written by students that really give a sense and a flavor of the community. And of course, it doesn't have to be about the community. It can be about anything, whatever is of interest. although they'll have to check and make sure there isn't a Wikipedia article already there about it, although of course they can always edit it and make it better. So what do you think? Any ideas for applications or uses for something like Delicious?
We don't have bookmarks for kids, so they can't save them and block them out, so you lose them. So unless you have it in on an email, if you've given them an email, you can store it there, but they can either write it in a blog, or if they have that, or they can go to Delicious and they can have bookmarks in it. Or else I'd have to write it on a web page or something, save those bookmarks.
So this actually gives them bookmarks where they didn't have it. Wow, you lock out bookmarks?
Yep.
Why?
They rewrite the profile.
Oh, they always rewrite it, sure. And so there's no point having them because they'll lose them.
So this
actually creates a capacity that hasn't been there.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, this is going to be really useful. So much more useful than I thought it would be. I'm glad I talked about this.
How about the folks out in Wolf Creek there? Any feedback or comments on the usefulness of or application of this?
I can see this being used, especially in research projects or web quests, where a teacher would just set up a bunch of bookmarks where kids can go and research a subject and click around so everybody starts at the same place and looks at the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I know yesterday I was out in Hinton dealing with Learn Alberta, did a workshop with K-3 social studies teachers, and one of the teachers brought with her a couple of posters of an exploration of their community. Mm-hmm. And they've gone out and taken pictures of various buildings and sites and whatnot around the community. And I think the idea of community was part of the grade 4 social studies curriculum.
Sure.
And they had, you know, commented on the development of the town or the history associated with each one of these images and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, this would be a logical next step for them to take.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Black Gold, any comments from your end?
I haven't found it that easy to use, so I'm really not encouraged to use it. There's too many obstacles. What I did find, though, is Grand Yellowhead's now on the recent list of items to look up, so it
worked. That's interesting.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, I'll put it on my list of things to do then to write up an application that you can download and run on your own system that'll do this for you. I'll check out Steve Mallett's site and see what he's done. Because it's too useful not to be used. Another site which does pretty much the same thing is called Furl, FURL.com. And again, it's the same sort of concept. I don't know why we have car loans as a it's just got to be a spam site. Hang on. Furl.net, not .com. Boy, that's annoying. And the funny thing is, I still remember the big debate that took place in the 90s, the mid-90s, about whether there should be any commercial content at all on the internet. And all the doomsayers and naysayers were saying exactly this is what would happen. So members recently furled, and again, this is a tag, right? And canister bottles. I'm not sure if I want to click on that. Oh well. Yeah, here's an instance of furl spam. So that's really annoying too. But basically it does the same thing. Now, I mentioned Flickr yesterday. And one of the features that Flickr supports also is tagging for photographs. And so Flickr supports the same sorts of tag clouds that you get in Delicious when it works. So if you sent out your students on a photography assignment or something like that and had them all come back and upload their photos to Flickr or something like that, they could all tag their photos the same way, and then that would create a photo set on Flickr consisting of all the photos created by all the people in that class. Again, my observation is what we really need are applications that can be installed in schools or at the board level so that you're not sharing it with the entire world and fighting with tags. And there isn't really Flickr spam, happily, but not yet. Sooner or later, someone will figure out. Flickr is a lot more stable because it's been bought by, who bought it? Yahoo. So it's going to be around for a while, and it will have the bandwidth and the speed, which is good. Now, related to this, and I'm going to go back to all the way back, to my samples page. I don't know why I called it samples. I had no imagination. Related to this is a set of applications that fall under the general heading social networks. I just want to show you that they exist. You're going to find this of limited use in schools, but probably your students have accounts on some of these or another. You've almost certainly heard of a place called MySpace, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. If you haven't, you should have a look at that, because your students may be on it, and who knows what they're showing. This one here is called Orkut, and it's created by Google. And I'm just going to log into it here, and again, the usual. Won't it be nice when all of these sites just recognize my personal distributed identity? So I don't have to type in or register every time I go to one of these things.
Tell somebody to get your personal.
Yeah,
it would be really like my brother-in-law's card that was in Portugal not too
long. Yeah.
There you go.
Biometric.
Well, no, these. I've got a long paper on why that won't do the trick. Yeah, my own position on this is self-declaration of identity is the way to go. And then you associate your identity with access to a specific web page or server site that only you control. And then if somebody steals your identity, you just change the password on that site and they're toast. So, and... like I said, I do have some articles on that. If you look up MIDM using Google, you'll find my stuff on that. I have many interests. So this is Orkut, and as you can see, I have various friends on Orkut. I have a couple of people who want to add me, or somebody add me. Somebody added me as a friend. I don't know these people. So, in
section of the friend, I assume you can then turn out to not be very friendly.
You can have unfriendly.
They could turn out to be unfriendly. But you can go to their Orkut page. This is their personal profile on Orkut, and it's all in Portuguese. For some reason, Orkut is very popular in Brazil. They've just taken to it. And I don't know why. These are people that I actually do know, except for Foucault, who's dead. I know it was sad, but it was 1984, so... So obviously there is a little bit of identity spoofing happening. That's okay. Here are some communities that I belong to. Pearl and analytic philosophy and so on. I have fans. I have 9 fans, which is actually 9 more than I thought I would have, so I'm actually pretty happy.
Are they also your friends?
Most of them are, yeah. So, I have a message which I'm not going to read because I don't know what it says. But the idea is, you can search for people. ORCID spreads, the way a site like ORCID spreads is you decide you're going to add somebody to your network and you type in their email address and then it sends them an email saying, so-and-so would like to be your friend on ORCID. And if you don't have an account, you are then invited to join ORCID, create an account so that you can be so-and-so's friend. So they spread very rapidly. And MySpace, for example, maybe I'll just take a quick look at it here so we actually see it. It's owned by Rupert Murdoch, which should tell us everything we need to know. And so, and here we go with MySpace. And, oh, I am home. So, you know, cool new people, MySpace music and all of that. We can browse through the groups. Let's pick a safe group, not that one. Animal Defense League, private groups, public groups, people helping people. That looks like a nice group. I can just join the group. And now, of course, since I haven't logged in, it's going to prompt me to log in. Here are some people that belong to that group. And let's look at one of their... This is this person's personal page. At 21 years old, he's older than the average ORCID or MySpace member. And just like ORCID, right, he's got friends.
He seems to have a lot of friends who are lots younger than him, female.
Yeah. And if you explore these sites, and I do recommend exploring these sites, you might have to do it from home, but it's just amazing what people put up there. And, you know, I always recommend to teachers and to people in schools that they do take a look at the sites. Possibly some of their students are posting things. You sort of have to be a little bit diplomatic when you do this, because it's funny. People post these things on the open internet. Anybody can find them, and yet they treat them as though they're a private space. And if a parent or a teacher goes looking at them, it feels like an intrusion to them. Not to everyone, of course, but certainly to some of them. Those spiders beginning to get to me. So you kind of have to be diplomatic, but I think it's a necessary thing to do to see what's there, but not to broadcast that, if that makes sense. So like I say, you're probably less likely to use these applications in the schools specifically, but it's important to know that they exist and that these networks will be used by your students to exchange information about themselves, stories, whatever. So there's this whole communications network lurking under the surface.
So, Stephen, what is motivating the hosts to put these kinds of resources out there? What's to be gained by the people that are capitalizing the storage space?
Right. There's three major things. First of all, there's a market in premium services, and that varies from site to site, but depending on the nature of the site, they may give you more bandwidth to upload photos, they may give you more capacity to see information about other people, whatever. The model is different for every site, but premium services are very common. The second major thing is advertising. And we saw the flashing spiders there. That's making a lot of money for that site because the site is so popular. And then the third, and I think the most important thing, is the marketing information that they get. Because what the providers of these sites are doing is creating associations between demographics and interests. So, for example, somebody who owns a site like MySpace will be among the very first to spot a trend among 14-year-old girls. Because they have a pool of 50,000, 100,000 14-year-old girls on MySpace who are adding content and tagging things and spreading ideas from point to point. So Rupert Murdoch is the first thing to know that 14-year-old girls are now into, pick a fad. And that is valuable marketing information which they then sell. A lot of these sites would like to get this as personalized as possible. Sometimes they sell the email addresses to direct marketers, and the direct marketers send emails out to the members, which are then filtered by the spam filters. It's not really that productive. But the targeted advertising is, if you will, the holy grail of all of this stuff. If they can learn as much about you as possible, then they can direct advertising to you. And that raises what's called the CPM, or cost per thousand, of ad space. And the higher you can get that CPM, the more money your site makes.
But is it...
Go ahead.
But is it chicken or the egg? Like, I think that what they're really trying to do is dictate that. I don't think they're trying to respond to what the kids are getting into, what the kids are used to. I think they're trying to manipulate the fact.
I think that's a good observation, and a far more cynical observation than I was ready to go with in this session.
Well, let's go even further if we want to go down the road of cynicism. So, kind of gray areas, let's go right to the dark side here and talk about collecting personal information and identity theft. How can we trust these people to only dabble in the kind of gray areas of targeted marketing and not be concerned about them moving even further into identity theft? And how do we know that the demographic that say they're 14-year-old girls really are 14-year-old girls?
Well, of course you can't. But, go to one of these sites and look at one of these personal pages. You're getting so much information. Pictures and writing and so on, that I think you can make a pretty reasonable inference as to whether the person is a real 14-year-old or not. I think there's enough information to make that call. I think it would be really hard to spoof it. There's no question people do try to spoof it, but I think it's hard. The identity theft thing is an issue, but again, you're looking at sites like Friendster, Orkut, which is run by Google. Like, Google has really no upside to identity theft. Rupert Murdoch, for all his faults, isn't really going to make identity theft a business. So these sites are typically backed by large companies. Microsoft has MSN Spaces. Microsoft isn't going to steal your identity. So we can be pretty sure that the owners of these sites, especially the large ones, are just going to stay in the shady gray area and aren't going to go completely over to the dark side. So then it becomes a question of what information about yourself are you putting up on your personal profile page that allows other people to learn about you and to find things out about you. And you've probably seen this in your schools already. It's certainly the case that students need to be cautioned about the sorts of information that they put out. Like, completely verboten would be things like their address or their phone number or any sort of direct contact information. That should just be completely out. And then the obvious things, don't put your credit card number up there. Don't put your if you have a social insurance number, don't put that up there. I think for the most part, people, even young people, are reasonably aware of this. But they're young, so they're careless. And so I think, and that's another reason why teachers and administrators should be looking at these sites to make sure that they're not being careless. so that the information can be pulled back as necessary. I think it's something to be aware of. I'm not seeing the use of these kinds of sites as being a major cause of identity theft at the moment. I think your garbage is a much more likely cause, because you know your bills will be on there, your account numbers and all of that, unless you're shredding your bills, which I also recommend. So, you know, I mean, they're safe if you act safe, I think would be my basic response. And I think that we as educators have a role to watch over students and make sure that they're acting safe.
That brings up a question. Like, I'm curious for the teachers here, how much part of the curriculum is internet safety? Is it ever raised?
Yeah. Like, we address it, like, I'd personally sit down with every student in school once a year, yeah, and they sign acceptable use, and it has
that's their end, but I mean as far as like not what Stephen just talked about, not giving their real name, not giving their real address, is that a formal part of any classes anywhere?
Do you formally, like, do you build that into any courses where you formally sit down in classes, like, regularly or whatever, and discuss, like, identity theft and, like,
I basically built it between part of my health class and part of my internet stuff, because I have kids that are doing we had Pixel being used, and the five girls were all in the same class would leave school and then they would go home and fight, and then they got on there because I had misused my web manager there and allowed them to get on at school and didn't realize it. So they were fighting. They're in the same classroom in the same lab, calling them all names. So then we went back and we gave them a big article on blogging, a big thing, and said, these are the things you have to do to get back on the computers. I've talked about it. It was watching something on Oprah shows and that stuff, that video.
I'm going from the other end. Kurt, you're talking about their acceptable use. Yeah. I'm talking about safety. Like
we teach them what about sex.
Yeah, protect themselves. Yeah. Not inappropriate use that they're doing. Yeah. Like to protect themselves.
Because of the inappropriate use that I've seen, we started showing them things that were to help them to learn why this is a bad thing. Right. Showed them a video from Oprah that she did, where the guy sat in one town and found the kid in Chicago at a school based on the stuff that they posted online, and walked up with a camera crew, never seen this kid in his life, and said, you're the kid I was talking to online because I made you wear that hat. And that's how we knew. They found two kids in two different places within a few weeks, and then I showed that to my kids. And kids, the girls that were on there more than the boys, because they use it at that age more, but 12, 13-year-olds, and had a heart attack. You should see the faces of my girls when I showed them this thing.
But what we're talking about...
Yes.
But it's not
individual teachers are responding to individual incidents in school.
Okay.
It's not standardized, that's not formalized.
I shouldn't use that as part of my option class.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're doing, but we're all just shooting from the hip.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
No. Maybe.
And there should be
some. At a traditional level, we could sit down.
Any input here from our remote sites, Black Bold? Any comments from your end on safety in this area?
Well, we have these issues. In fact, during the meeting yesterday, I was pulled out. There's a site called Nexopia out of Edmonton, which is notorious around here, and there's a lot of cyberbullying going on between a couple of girls in one of our schools, and the principal needed to take a look at it, so we had to unblock it so he can take a look. And again, this stuff is happening from the home. It's not happening in schools, but it spills over into the schools.
What was that site again?
It's called Nexopia. N-E-X-O-P-I-E-A, something like that.
I-A.
I-A, yeah.
I-A, sorry.
Nexopia?
Yeah. Nexopia.
There we go.
That's one.
Yeah. Yeah, this one's a new one to me.
Who's in the
well with kids bullying each other, or
we've lost each one by using
happening outside the school, but it's the school is kind of the common ground between these students, and so as the school's mentioned that we've had, I don't know, maybe a dozen police investigations with threats. You probably know about the one in the media of our student that contacted somebody from Ontario who pretended that he was a 16-year-old boy or something, and she was hauled off the airplane by the Toronto police as the plane landed in Toronto, and just happened to be put together by the Lacombe police, just exactly what was going on, because mom was concerned. They managed to do a little forensics enough to figure out what was going on and pull her off the airplane before she met up with this guy in Toronto, who turned out to be, 46 years old or something? Using his mother's credit card to buy a plane ticket. She was on the plane. She was going to meet her at the airport. So, in terms of, maybe we are a little bit of a shot in the dark at it, but it is part of the ICT break of internet safety. But you can cover it off or not effectively is hard to say.
What's the attraction of people wanting to put themselves up on these websites and doing this?
Well, certainly expressing creativity. I mean, my own feeling is people express themselves, and they always express themselves, and pretty well all people express themselves in some way, and this is a way to do it, and it's a way to do it where they will get an audience of some sort, whether it's of their peers or people around the world. And then the way they express themselves is in the sorts of things that they're interested in. I think this is really creative. I love the laser eyes. I mean, that's some of the best animation I've seen. You know? It's funny, if you didn't go in here, this could be one of your students. I mean, he's in Edmonton. 16-year-old in Edmonton. Well, maybe not one of your students, but yeah.
No, we just went through and did a location search on Hinton, and yeah. I've gone through and found at least 3 current students and 10 or 15 ex-students just from high school.
Exactly.
Yep. They're probably not presenting themselves how you'd like.
No.
So that raises the issue, are people behaving as if, it's almost like when everyone's watching you behave like nobody's watching.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So are we seeing really how these kids want to present themselves, or is this just the first stroke of social engineering? Are these kids responding to the environment we're providing for them?
Well, obviously, it's a mixture of both, right? I mean, clearly they respond to things, right?
I think the environment at home is far more open than school ever would be. I have so many people who have a computer with high-speed internet access in their bedroom.
Yeah.
Like sure.
And who's monitoring that? Mom and dad don't even know how to turn it on, let alone.
And so then it comes to, as educators, in so many ways, if the home isn't gonna, but if the parents aren't gonna parent the kids, then we almost have to. You know what I mean? It's not something you can walk away from. You know, if the parents don't have the capacity to give good advice and guidance and stuff in this area, then we can't just say, it's happening at home, we can't do it. You know what I mean? I think
Well,
a lot of this is just about morality. It's about morality. It's about respect for self,
right?
But those students don't perceive themselves to be low in self respect. They, at that time, when they're adolescent and full of hormones, that's what they want to present.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a medium through which they can do it.
Yeah, we might not feel comfortable with it.
Yeah.
But
this is how they speak.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And I think one thing that, to sort of step back and maybe follow up on what James is saying here is that, I think we have to recognize that inherent change in
in the use of the internet.
Right.
So it used to be a tool that you used to surf, and it used to be sort of an electronic treasure hunt for information or knowledge or whatever it happens to be. And now what we're looking at is that instead of a medium through which you travel, it's an area or a space or a place that you inhabit now.
Right.
And
exactly.
Communities are starting to form. Just the language that's been used here today on these websites, communities, friends, that sort of idea of inhabiting the space is something that I think we as teachers have to become aware of. And I don't know if we look at changes in our ICT curriculum to accommodate that changing nature of the environment, or whether we have to do it outside, in our other courses. But I think the issues that we're bringing up here are ones that need to be discussed.
I think they absolutely need to be discussed. And the other thing that's relevant here too is because most of their access takes place outside of the school and in their locked bedroom or whatever, there's no element really through which you can require them not to do things, and it has to be a process of education and of convincing rather than of rules and regulations, because they're in a position, the internet gives them the capacity to simply ignore the rules and the regulations, and as you can see, they ignore them in spades.
I think we need to take a look at a proactive kind of an approach to it. I think our mandate is to prepare our charges, our students for the future, and this is a component of that.
If it was me, I'd probably get thrown out of the school for doing this, but what I would do is unblock one of these sites and start showing some of these pages in the classroom, because that would make people very aware. You look at the reaction.
I don't think so.
You don't think so? Well, think about that. Think about that, because how more clearly can you show the impact of these pages except by having these pages provide an impact? And, you maybe not might not want to show the pages of your own students because they might, but I don't know, maybe think about that. But
is this something?
But hiding from it and keeping it completely out of the classroom, I think, is a non-starter.
I think for the most part, they don't think aware of
anything. Right, exactly.
Like the one the kids I was talking about yesterday, they set up a site, some of our students set up a site, and it was similar sort of thing, but they just used their own space, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying about that, I had to take the survey of who's the hottest teacher and stuff.
Right.
As soon as they knew that we knew, nobody did see that.
That's right.
So that's but they did. Obviously, they just move on to other stuff. But now they know to use MySpace and a few Netopia and stuff. But it's like I mean, lots of the activities that that the kids get into that I don't think they should be getting into and stuff. Like, it's not the fact that there's pictures of the kids all drunk and stuff and doing things that I would really choose for them at that age. They're still going to do those activities whether it's posted on the internet or not.
Right.
You know, it's not the fact that it's on the internet that bothers me as much as what they're doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's like my teachers probably didn't really want to know what I was doing outside of class when I was that age.
Yeah. Any comments from Wolf Creek down there?
Back to Steve's comment about opening up these sites and showing the students that may work in some situations, but when we're dealing with, I just have to assume that we have 12-year-olds and younger accessing these sites and posting information. I'm not going to have very many receptive parents or teachers open to the idea of exposing these children to these different sites. Even though with the education aspect, I can understand that, but there's going to be a whole lot more resistance if we show them what's out there. There's an attraction to going home where they aren't supervised, and they showed us at school. So
I think this is the same argument that we had a number of years ago with the introduction of sex ed into our calm program.
It's a pretty similar argument. Yeah, it's a good analogy.
And it does teach them, like, in our school, it teaches kids about balance. Yeah. Because that's relevant for those kids. Yeah, they're going to go out into the backcountry and take right. risks.
So they might as well
say, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. They're going to be in a risky environment. Let's give them some tools to work with. But really, it's all about making good decisions. That's what it
is. It's about making good decisions, and it's about preparing people how to make those decisions, and you know, how to think things through, and to anticipate consequences of their actions. And they need, I guess, first of all, to understand that there are consequences, and that you need to be able to show that, and then to give them the tools that allow them to figure out what those consequences will be. Because you can't, and this is the other thing too, you can't predict the emergence of this stuff. I had never heard of Nexopia, and so, you know, I would never have been in the position to say, well, look at this site, here's what you shouldn't be doing, or anything like that. And these social networking sites are only the latest iteration of the sorts of things that have been popping up on the internet, you know, and who knows what it's going to be next year. So I think that they need more general tools to be able to react to new things like this in general, rather than to be reacting specifically to how you deal with Nexopia or how you deal with MySpaces or whatever. And that's hard. That's going to take some thinking.
It's going to be interesting in like 10 years time when, like, you know, it won't just be embarrassing pictures of politicians when they're smoking a joint or something when they're 18. Now it's going to be, because this stuff's out there, like, it's never gone. Just like an email, it's never gone.
No, it's going to be hidden somewhere, they're going to find it.
Yeah, somebody's going to
have
there.
A lot of dirt on some people.
Yeah.
Just a couple of other sites. I'm not sure. Yeah, I hit Friendster is another one. Oh, I got a whole bunch of. Here we go. And again, same sort of thing. This has a slightly older demographic. It's one of the earlier social networking sites. It was wildly popular, but a lot of these 24 million people have gone elsewhere. And LinkedIn is a site that uses the same sort of approach, but it's very focused and directed toward professionals. And so the average age on this site is considerably higher. It is a very popular site for people who are looking for work. They develop professional networks, and then work these networks to find a job. So of course, I have memberships in all of these things. I have more memberships out there. And all those sites that say, oh no, we never send spam to your address, my spam filters on average about 1,000 spam messages a day, because I have accounts on all of these sites. So here's LinkedIn. So, and then I've got a bunch of people that are connected to me. I don't really keep track of these connections. It's just when the invite comes in, I just approve it, because I don't use LinkedIn seriously at all. But you see the sorts of people here, right? Coalition strategist, telecommunications manager at Lulu.com. Lulu.com is a really interesting self-publishing site. If you ever want to publish a book and you don't like publishers, go to Lulu.com. Right, founder of Skip Identity, yeah, things like that. A very more professionally oriented site. It's actually pretty, it's useful, although I don't use it. Go figure. But I think this is probably a good time to take a short break, because we've already got some people taking a break. So why don't we take 15 minutes at this point, and that will take us to, I don't know what time it will take us to.
5 after 10.
Does that sound good with everyone?
Yeah.
All right. L-U-L-U. It's lu.lu.com. Did I say lu.lu? L-U-L-U.com. Whoops, need a period in there. Oh.
It's just a OC generation.
Jeez. Okay, so for those of you who are listening online, we'll be back in about 5 seconds. Okay.
Okay, can we get everybody's attention again? We'll start rolling. Good. Thank you.
Okay, well, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back online, those of you listening by audio. Yes, I'm always thinking of you. Okay. Where we're going to go now, if everybody's happy with this, is to some of the samples that I've dredged up of the use of some of these technologies online. So I'm going to pop back into the samples page. We'll actually do the samples part of the samples page. These are just some things that I dug up from around the net. Some of them I know and some of them I don't, but that's okay. Oh, and I forgot to add one. Oh, well, that's okay. I'll get back to that later. I put it in my newsletter instead of on this page. Basically, what this list here is, and it starts where we see the word examples, just various uses of some of these technologies in different classrooms around the world. And what I'm going to do here is just sort of step through them. I don't have a whole lot to say about them, which is why I've sort of been putting off talking about them. But I'll show them to you, and then what I'd like for all of you to do is to if you will, react to them or add your own commentary. Could you do something like this yourself? Or is there something that would prevent you from doing this in your own school? Or how you would have to change this to make it work in your own environment? So I'll be depending as much on you for the discussion of these as on me, which is probably a good thing for everyone. So this is a fairly straightforward one right off the top here. Grade 12 English class, and it's more of a description than the sample itself, but it's still nonetheless useful. Simply providing feedback to English language learners using blogs. And the reason why I pulled out this as an example is because one of the things I liked about it is that it shows the direct link between the research that's out there and the use of blogs in this environment. So we see, and you've seen this research elsewhere, I'm sure, as well, students benefit from timely constructive feedback, or effective feedback refers to specific criteria and skills. The one that really caught my idea, caught my eye, is this one. Low-income students have a strong desire to use technology to express themselves, which I find not simply interesting, but important. Because what something like this shows me is that one of the major benefits of using this sort of technology, even though we still have to some degree a digital divide, is that it provides a much greater level of access to people, both in terms of access to information and resources that they need, such as direct personal feedback on writing or other assignments in their English class, but also access to a means for them to express themselves and be read and be heard by their teachers. There used to be, when all this online learning stuff first came out, there used to be a bunch of discussion about how people who might be reticent to express themselves in a public forum such as a classroom, and perhaps even in a video conferencing classroom, are nonetheless more willing to express themselves online. We just popped into those social networking sites and we've seen they are certainly willing to express themselves online. And so there's a great deal of discussion of that. So it provides this extra outlet and this extra access for people. And that's always been very important to me. Thoughts or comments?
Well, I'll jump in here. I know that within the video conferencing environment that one of the key kind of concerns that we do have is the issue of everything in a video conference environment is done in public.
Right.
In real time, in public, with images of people who are can respond to you almost face to face, you know, in real time.
and you do run into a lot of students that are a little reticent to engage and communicate in that kind of an environment. And we've been dreaming up and looking at using other technologies to try and facilitate the one-on-one kind of communications and the ability to communicate with, you know, maybe with the instructor initially, but maybe with a larger community that sort of gets rid of some of those barriers, some of those social barriers for communication, and maybe this is something that we can pursue. I don't know if the folks in Wolf Creek or in Black Wolf have experienced the same sort of thing or are contemplating that in a video conference environment or not. I'm looking forward to hearing your responses if you are, or have, or will be.
Definitely here at Wolf Creek we're contemplating that, and we're looking at how we can facilitate that. We're specifically looking at facilitating that within first class if we're able to do that. But you know, we'll see as we move down this road. Hopefully we can learn from each other.
All right, thanks.
All right, Black Gold, we're looking at our video conferencing courses to be done in association with online courses. So some of that we're hoping will naturally flow from what's built into the online. And there is a communication facility built into the online stuff we use.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, it occurs to me that had I really been thinking ahead of time, I keep meaning to do this, and then I keep not doing this, I would have had another screen set up somehow, I don't know how, but where we could have what's called a back channel, where everybody who's online, you know, either here or in the other communities, would be able to type in messages using IRC or some other chat program. So I could see the people commenting. So I don't, you know, I don't even need to interrupt my sentence. I just see what people are saying up there. And then, so especially for people on remote sites, they don't have to go like, please pay attention to me. Because, yeah, it gets discouraging when you're in the remote site and you want to be heard and nobody's looking at you. And me with my glasses right now, I can't even see that well. So, but having that back channel, I think, would have been really useful. I didn't talk at all about IRC today. IRC is old, old technology, so, but it's still really useful.
Just having the messenger up in first class would be good.
Sure.
That little window would do it.
Yeah, that little window would do it, yeah. The trick is to have it up.
Yeah.
So that everyone can see it, you know.
Yeah.
They've started doing that at conferences. It's kind of funny because people can post anonymously at these conferences. And the speaker's up there and have the screen, and you know, there's names being called, and you know, comments about the presenter. Of course, so you have to mount the screen behind the presenter, so otherwise it just throws them right off. Hey, you guys can blog feedback about this session in your blogs because I'll be aggregating them. So. Just out of curiosity, now, because I was wondering about this, now that you all have blogs, how many of you are contemplating continuing to maintain your blog?
Now that I put all my stuff on here, I'm just going
to
go and write his blog.
Go write his blog,
yeah. Yeah, I just added everybody's to my blog line, so then I don't have
to. You just read all of their stuff. Yeah. I mean, the nice thing about having a blog like this is, like, you can add to it, and then you can ignore it for 4 months, and then something comes up, you add to it again, and the neat thing is, I'll see it the instant you add it.
But is there a lifespan for that stuff? You know, like, I don't know, lots of the email accounts, like Yahoo or Hotmail.
They're dormant.
Yeah,
so they lose
it, right?
Yeah, it varies depending on the service, but... I don't know what it is. 3 months sounds about like the right number, but I couldn't guarantee it. And the thing is, do these services say we will delete your account after 3 months? No, they don't. They often leave them up there. I had a long discussion with the people who run Flickr about this, because I don't take care of my Flickr account at all. I'm really sloppy with it. But I don't want it to go away. And Flickr has this thing, you know, we will delete your account. And I'm sort of like, please don't delete my account. And they come back and they say, no, we don't delete accounts. So there you go. But it's a good idea every once in a while to post something, and then that starts that timer all over again. You don't have to post a lot. But yeah, I think you really do need to maintain it. Here's one I liked. Posting student art on a blog. And it seems so simple, right? You know, you just take a photograph of some art, put it in a blog. That's all there is to it. But what this does is it gets that art out there. It's not just simply sitting on a school wall where it'll be seen by people in the school and maybe some parents and teachers, but you know the whole world can see it now. And you know you can get some really nice reproductions of it. Of course, the artwork itself here you'll notice is stored on Flickr, so you're not really worrying about the storage issues. And then it's just linked in from the Blogger account. This is an EduBlog site. That's the site that we saw yesterday, the one that was set up by James Farmer. So, when I was in school, I used to do all kinds of projects like this. And the school was half filled with my displays and posters by the time that I left. So this really appeals to me.
I know maybe this brings up the question, as you alluded to earlier here, of you know, doing this internally within our school division versus doing it out.
That's what we were just saying, with that RWD stuff.
Yeah.
Before we got the RWD, like, I could see, like, as an individual teacher, this would be a great advantage, because they don't want FTP, they don't know about HTML or whatever.
Yeah.
But having got the RWD stuff, or being on the brink of that now,
right.
It's like a comparable environment, but with a lot more regulation.
Right.
It doesn't have all the advantages, that's quite a lot.
Then with your iOS, you still go back to the point kind of issues, put things up on the net, whether it's a kid's work, like it is, like in this example, the tree, like, the tree there,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's an opinion or something, there are all kinds of poisonous things, all the forms that we collect at the beginning of the year,
right.
that you hope cover this, which your is ass. Very nice, yeah, my ass.
For those listening online, FOIP, Freedom of Information and Personal Privacy. So here's a page full of examples. I like this one because they're sort of nicely organized and they match the categories in my educational blogging article. Oops. It helps if I type it in right. This article here you might find useful. It's on the EduCause website. And it's going to load slowly. Naturally. On educational blogging. And I talk about a lot of the uses of blogging in this article. As down here a ways. Well, you know, you can read that. I'll post that link onto the wiki page here so that you can get to it. See this? I just love the wiki because I'm just going to Google it here. And, actually, I'm logged in. I forgot that I was logged in. Never mind, I'll just do it this way. Copy this. Pop back in here, pop into, oops, not home anymore, wee, and edit, but I am logged in, oh right, I have two login systems, oh, yeah. the old one's a lot slower. And anyhow, while we're waiting for that, we'll come back here. So, right off the bat, blogs is an administration tool for class notes, assignment deadlines, links, other classroom information. And here are some examples. Ms. Nelson's fifth grade class. And of course, it was Martin Luther King Day in the States, so the text of the I Have a Dream speech was posted. Well, actually, no, it's something. Oh, okay, this is different. It's, looks like each of the students in the class has given us their one sentence dream. That's kind of cool. That's a neat idea. And you get, it's interesting, I'm looking at this, right? Okay, you know, that all the violence and terror in the world would stop, that's good. You know, like, that all liquor would be banned. You know, funny. It's funny what people dream of.
Well, this is your job, Dad.
So, Unit 21, suffixes, E-N-I-Z-E, broken, frightened. Yes. So this, yeah, it's just the teacher putting up stuff. Here's class pictures of a poetry presentation. December book report. Your book report for the month of December is to, there's the assignment, and they'll never lose that piece of paper. Let's see if I'm logged in. Yes, I am. The old system really was slow. There we go, and oops, wrong page. So I've added that link to educational blogging on the samples wiki page, and again it's being a bit slow, but it should show up when you reload it momentarily. Yeah, now you'll see it if you reload it. It's right under the grade 12 English link. And we have Mr. McDowell's World History class here. So, Industrial Revolution Project, here's the project link, and we'll go, so here's the information about the project, the WebQuest for 10th grade world history. WebQuests are really popular, and then you can have the students do the WebQuest and then report the results back on their own personal blogs. And you can also check your grade, let's see if the grades are being posted. Well, okay, I guess we can't get into those. I always try. It's just a point of pride that, you know, if there's something locked away, you try to go through it. I know I shouldn't, but it's official. We have started. This webpage will serve as a hub, etc. He hasn't used it a lot, has he? You'd think he'd use it more. But again, you know, you don't have to use it every day or all the time or for everything. It's just, it's there. It's a tool in your toolbox that you use. And here's one more, ElizabethFullerton.com, notes over Anglo-Saxons. There you go. And she simply uploaded a Microsoft Word document. So, pretty handy. All about the Anglo-Saxon period, etc. This looks like I'm going to stop now and read this. I like Anglo-Saxons and history.
I think we're sort of looking at paralleling this, at least within our video conference courses, using the first class ed module as sort of a,
yeah,
you know, maybe a knockoff of WebCT kind of an environment for an instructional tool.
Sure.
To provide some of this kind of access, but
and without some of the downfalls of WebCT, which seems to be
in the U of A where we couldn't even hardly run our WebCT because it was crashing the servers, and there were some people logged into it. Maybe we'd avoid some of those problems having all that extra hardware in the background and stuff is hosted somewhere else.
Yeah, again, it's not the specific technology that's important here. It's the new ways of using this technology and providing more interaction and communication that's important. And if first class does the job, great, because you already got it. You know, and it doesn't make sense to go outside what you've already got if you can make what you have do the sorts of things you want.
But I think it's valuable to see examples like this so that we can see what has been done with it in the past. And as I say, that first class ed is, we're still working with a beta version of it.
Right.
And, it is nice to see applications that might be transferable.
And maybe they'll pick up their market share as a result of this. Blogs as a discussion tool. And we talked a little bit about that yesterday. And you can see the inputs going in from the teachers and then the things being read and being discussed by each other. And we've got Mrs. Lowe's class here as an example. And she hasn't been using it this fall, but we see stuff back from the April of 2005, March of 2005. And what she's doing here, and this turns out to be important, is she's prompting specific responses from people. So she's asking a very specific question. What do you think is the most important thing we have done to prepare for the test? Because, I've seen this with discussion lists as well, where a teacher will say, okay, great, we've got this discussion list, or we have this open area, and I want you to go talk now. And then they just leave it. And they sort of wonder why the students aren't going to the discussion area discussing. And the problem is, of course, that they have nothing to talk about. And so it turns out to be important to prompt the discussions with something like a very focused, specific question that they can answer and that they need to answer. It's a point of dispute or some debate as to whether you require an answer. And a lot of teachers will give grades for the submitted comments in the discussion environment. Others think that that's not as appropriate and that it should be more just sort of like talking in class or whatever. But really, it depends on the teacher, it depends on the subject, it depends on the class, which way you go with that. And, it's going to be different in every circumstance.
I like this as well, because whenever you're posting journal kind of entries, you either get all the same kind of entries, or kids don't know what to write.
Yeah.
You look at this, and you walk in, and you go, oh, good, there's already 7 reflections. What are these guys write? Well, I don't agree with any of these. What about this one? You might get, at least, you'll get some people that will be more willing to look at, to contribute, and then maybe have a different idea.
Yeah.
I don't want to be like everybody else. I'm going to try this. I can do my own spin on. That's when you say, now you owe 4 reflections.
And I think what you do see in the course delivery, especially in online course delivery, is a lot of mandated quantity. Like thou shalt have 2 submissions a week or
and
whatever.
And they reflect on 2 people's things that have already been posted and what you think about it.
It's really good as well for giving some feedback to teach you too, right? Because I bet quite often you'll be surprised about, you'll say to the kids, what's the most important thing we did this week? And they all think the most important thing was, having recess or something. But they might be completely off topic, and you might think, I didn't quite communicate as effectively as I wanted to on something, or, I placed too much emphasis on something else, so it's good feedback.
Yeah.
But you better than wait until after the test, right? Because it's done then. You get the feedback, I screwed up.
And again, thinking of the video conference environment that a number of our teachers here are working in or contemplating working in, we try and use just simple email as a means of communication, doing some of the one-on-one kind of question and answer kind of stuff.
But again, there's reluctance on the part of the student for to email a teacher.
But if you mandate it, and say, just a simple question.
Yep.
That okay, I want a response to this. Maybe as was stated here, an indication of what was the best thing that we did to review for this test, and expect that, and then it grows after the ice has been broken.
But in terms of like teaching a rec or like for assessment stuff like that, what about just printing chat, use first class chat, and then the teacher for 3D just prints out that chat log. That'd be a good read. Yeah, just keep a record somewhere.
Sure, and I was thinking about using the smart board to teach if you have it in your classroom. You put this in your notes, you have the link to your blog that's there that everybody's already responded to. You go back, you scroll through, you look at each individual response, you add things to it, and you save it as that day's journal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be good.
This is a comment you guys mentioned about printing up your chat log. You should actually print it out as PDF and then post it to a conference. That way
Yeah, definitely save it electronically. I personally hate PDFs, but I'm not going to go there. But absolutely save it electronically.
It does, but it's Adobe that takes forever to load.
Oh, right.
Yeah. 3,000 plugins to put in there. And then now we're ready for you to read it.
Yeah. A couple of things on this to note. I want to point out first that the way Mrs. Lowe is working here is the students don't have their own individual blogs. They are rather posting their responses as comments to her blog. And the other thing I want you to note, look how they're identified. Posted by 16. Posted by number 4. Posted by 23. So there's a certain degree of anonymity. Especially important given the discussion we had before the break, and yet there is still individual identity.
And I think that's one thing, again, to get back to the video conference area, that the students that I just talk with that are taking courses in this form, in a face-to-face environment, they have the ability to talk to the teacher one-on-one outside of class in the hallway, that kind of thing, and give some sort of feedback, and the teacher has a better idea of getting a grasp of what the student is doing and achieving and the difficulties they are having. One of the things that I've heard repeatedly from students is that it is really nice to have some way of anonymously getting that feedback back to the teacher.
Yeah.
And in cases where I go around and sit in on classes, I'm sort of that vehicle, because they can tell me and I can go back to the teacher and says, well, the group would like to have you do this or this or this or this work really well and that kind of thing, rather than Sally identifying herself and saying, I really don't like to do that. I'd like you to do this instead.
Let's think of something else too, that with the asynchronous learning is you still have the face-to-face with all your class. Like, those kids all know one another, and so you talk about, and they all said, when you read something posted online, you have no frame of reference for that person if you've never met them before.
Yeah.
And so how do you have a reasonable chat with somebody if you really haven't met them and don't understand what's funny, what's sarcastic, what's really angry? And so you have all these kids in class who would talk on a given day anyways, and then you go and read some of these postings. You still have that connection to them, so they know where a lot of the backgrounds of the postings are going on, as opposed to just, I post this and somebody from across the country reads it, and you have those. So you still have those connections that are there.
Let's go to that other example where they got lost FSL kids, ASL kids and stuff.
Any
go ahead.
Comments from Wolf Lake or Black Gold? No, so I'm remembering the names of the sites now. I'm so impressed with myself.
Peter, any comments from Black Gold?
Not right now. We're paying attention, but no extra comments.
Okay. Feel free to jump in here, and I'll try and monitor as we're going along here. How about Wolf Creek?
We're paying attention also, but no comments right now.
Okay, great, thanks.
This is The Secret Life of Bees, and again, this is Will Richardson and some people he's working with, and we've got postings of some student drawings and commentary and some really interesting stuff here. This is actually a very well-known site and discussion. It's one of the standard examples that people use. So it's certainly worth sitting down and looking at. And if you did a Google search on the Secret Life of Bees, and you might want to say, because there's a few things called the Secret Life of Bees out there. So the Secret Life of Bees, Richardson. You'll find more discussion of this example as well. And then one for me, in need of coffee. And it's just, you know, discussion, chat, interaction. Look at all the contributors here. See, what you can do with your Blogger account is that you can set up a blog and then invite other Blogger members to be contributors to the blog. So what they've done here is they've set up this in need of coffee blog and then invited all of these different people to be contributors to this blog, and it becomes what's called a group blog. And so you can have a group blog for your class where everybody contributes to the same environment. They're not really commenting, though. I'd like to see more comments.
I guess one thing that's interesting is, in this environment, it's really easy for the kids to, like, drift off task. And
yeah.
You know, so if you're working in this environment, it's really easy for the kids to be not paying attention at all to whatever curriculum area you're trying to study and just chatting with their buddies. So I guess you have to kind of decide, is that something you're going to try and regulate, or is that something you're going to try and embrace? And to what extent? And obviously, it probably depends on the group, individual students in the class that
you're
trying.
You have to give them a time limit. Give them the next 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But in the real world, like adults in the real world,
yeah,
probably spend a lot of time blogging and emailing and stuff while they're doing their task. So, are we kidding ourselves? You know, like, I don't know whether that's something we should be actively discouraging. Probably. But I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah.
But then, okay, so what if you open up an environment like this, right? What if all you do is give something to stimulate the gifted kids who basically could do the same work in half the time anyway? You know, then are you really being fair to those gifted kids, or are you just keeping them quiet while you get with the middle brackets?
And you know, to sort of follow up on that, I think this sort of begs us to talk a little bit about the, you know, the use of this from a mandated perspective in a course.
Yeah.
You know, and by doing that mandating, how does that change the nature of it?
Yeah.
You know, if it is sort of perceived as an underground kind of an activity that students engage in.
Yeah.
And,
all of a sudden it's not cool
that
you do in class.
Yeah, all of a sudden it's not cool. And I'm wondering here, you know, whether, you know, mandating is a route that we should go to.
And again, there's been a fair amount of discussion about that, because one of the things that has made blogs and blogging popular is that it's personal self-expression. And there's very much a relationship of ownership over your personal blog. And when you mandate that they do things, you're taking that ownership away from them. And that changes the relationship between the student and their online work. And possibly not for the better. Certainly that's how I feel about it.
This is a topic that we want to throw out for discussion here.
I think it probably has more validity than doing Apple. Like, we teach kids how to use PowerPoint, for example. I know we've like done death. Like, in all fairness, how many of those kids are likely to use those skills as a like definitive skill set when they graduate? Like, very few. They probably make, you know, 5,000 PowerPoints between K-12 and then one in their adult life, or none, right? But here's something that they might actually use for all kinds of like social like stuff, regardless of whatever career path they take.
The other thing is that when, if your team, maybe that's I don't really consider it to be teaching PowerPoint. I'm trying to teach.
No, students. I know.
And I agree. We do lots of them, and lots of Word documents. And what's the real benefit of typing out my good copy of that my kids can't spell, right?
You know, that teach them.
They just right click on and go ignore this spell and mistake anyway. So. But I think you're trying to teach them a skill set more like what do you need to learn to get on a machine? If I got a computer in front of me, what skills do I need to learn? If I had to teach my mother, who didn't use computers a lot, what things would she need to know that she can transfer from one thing to the next? Ultimately, you're looking for some skill sets you can do.
You're generic transfer.
Right, that's
right.
That. And then
yeah.
What do you
need to rule
around
your technology?
Or something else.
We're one of our first courses in UNF31 that we'll be teaching over video conference, and what kind of tools out there are available to help facilitate the mathematical equations being transferred over an internet medium?
NCTM website is one. They have a whole bunch of the teacher part of the NCTM website. You can go through there and they have a number of things that are there. There's four main sections here. I can't remember what it's called based off of the teacher stuff. And there's lessons and things that were in there. I assume from Math 31 because I looked at a bunch of other grades.
But is there an environment that would allow
NCTM,
for example,
teaching
math expression?
There's the math type and equation editor, which is
greatly.
Yeah. Oh, right. Have you tried it?
No, I'm just saying, like, wouldn't that be...
Yeah, but you might have the equations. You might have to do it in Word.
Yeah. If we're continuing.
You could bridge it a Word session with math type.
Just point your finger and it will magically click on the link.
Yeah, no, I know, and I'm just trying to think which one it was that...
Yeah.
There was... I can't remember if it's under Stanhill that they've done this. I think it's the Illuminations part. So then they can go in here, they have four sections, the activities, lessons, and standards, and web links. And you can go through, and they have, the only difference here is it's mapped to, all of map to all map for North America. It does follow the American curriculum closer than it does the Canadian curriculum. But you should be able to find the Illuminations of this stuff for Math 31.
So I'll post this link to the wiki. I'll put it just under the educational blogging link.
Oh, and there's another one, the National Library of Virtual Manipulatives, which has Java-enabled manipulatives that you can use for grade 1 all the way up to grade 12. So I assume it would also apply to Math 31.
The Learn Alberta site has links to
right.
Locally developed stuff by Ron Long and along the lines of virtual manipulatives for
okay.
display purposes. Also, Learn Alberta is putting a graphing tool up on the Learn Alberta site as of today. Okay? It should be downloadable. It's an executable kind of a file that you can download. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but it's supposed to be up and running today. That's one that we can take a look at. As far as, graphing calculators, there's simulators for those that are available. I think MathType would be the first one that comes to mind as far as a usable, piece of software for Math 31 use in building equations and doing the things like the limit symbols and the integration symbols and those kinds of unique kinds of characters.
It's nice that there was a login to Learn Alberta just sitting on this browser.
I don't think the Learn Alberta one has the there are the some applets there. But as I say, the graphing tool hasn't been displayed as yet.
Yeah, I don't see that.
But as I say, it was supposed to be up today sometime.
That's the one. Then you go to 9 to 12. They have all the jazz. All
right. I'm just copying this link here. 9 to 12. So, okay, and here's all these Yeah, neat little Java tools. Isn't this nice? Yeah, it sounds great. I'm just going to go away from it here for a sec to pop it into the wiki so that everybody else can have a quick look at it as well. I hate Java. Java always does stuff like that.
It overtakes everything that you're doing.
Yeah.
Again, the only thing about the National Library of Virtual Minutes is that we found that when we looked through it, it was off. Like, it was off by grade level. So if you were looking for grade 7, you're almost better off looking grade 3 to 5 to get the ones that are appropriate or do an all kind of search. So they work. Because they seem to be off by, they're on maybe more American standards.
Okay, so I posted the link to the wiki page here. So you can just click on MLVM. Well, reload the page first so it'll show up. And then you can pull up this page. And here's Diffy, which looks like kind of fun, I guess. Fill in the blanks with the differences. Okay, so let's put a 5 in here. And this is hard. 17. 18. And 6. And now what's going to happen? Anything? Ah, and now we go into the new level. And so it's just going to keep taking us down. I wonder what happens if I make a mistake.
They get boinged.
So that's kind of fun.
They have their standards and stuff like that they relate to.
Sure.
You know, does that address your question out there in Wolf Creek, or were we sort of off on a bit of a tangent here?
Well, I think we have a pretty good awareness of Alberta and those. But really what I'm thinking of is more of a co-editing space, so a student and a teacher over a distance could co-edit a mathematical expression.
I know what happens in Math 31 courses that we already have been running by by video conference is that the instructor has basically just put up the information in a Word document and has become very proficient as far as, you know, keyboarding and putting in things like, you know, exponents and subscripts and special characters and that kind of stuff. And has had the students come up and use the smart board interactively to write the solution or the steps and the solution to the problem. And there is, and I haven't tried this, but there is the ability to take you know, the text that's written or the handwriting and convert it into text later on. What she also tends to do is to take the open outlines, is what we call them, with the problems and the work that the students have done.
Yeah,
and
we did try that, Gord, but when you do, when you use MathType in Word and you transfer it over to Notepad, for example, it uses the subscripts and none of the text actually transfers effectively.
Well,
part of why we've had the trouble. Yeah. Like, you know, certainly you can use the annotation features of the smart board, but
you can use the collaboration functions in Office, but like you might, depends on how your network is set up, is that you might have some problems there. Yeah, like if you go into, if you're in Word, you can go into collaboration stuff, and then you can define the other people that can act, and then you can share it just like, what was that, the site we were on yesterday? The site?
Lightly.
Just like Lightly. You can do it like Lightly, you've got all the Word, it's all set up. That's cool.
One thing to sort of follow up on what our current Math 31 teacher does is, I said she has the open outline material that the students write in and that kind of stuff and saves that. But at the same time, she does have a typed version of the correct solution that she basically emails out to the students at the end of the class. Or, you know, she used to use the multifunction printers and just print, you know, send it off to the remote sites at the end of the day, so they had a print copy that she had created of what was created and constructed during the actual session.
So I just thought I'd take a flyer here and see if somebody had already invented a version of Writely with mathematical symbols, but it looks like that's still in the future.
Yeah.
but probably not for long, because it wouldn't take a whole lot to do it. It'd be some work, but you could certainly do it. So, okay, blogs as a publication tool. That was a good digression, though, because mathematics is one of these areas with this whole online thing that's always been an issue and a problem, right? And, I remember even back in the 90s, they were trying to create a MathML representation, and it just hasn't worked yet. It's coming, but it hasn't worked yet. Okay. East Side Bloggers Immigration Experience. And again, this is one of these group blogs. And so basically what a lot of this is people telling stories back and forth to each other. There's a lot of discussion, a lot of talk about the importance of storytelling, and especially by students being able to tell their own stories in some sort of forum where people will see them and hear them. And, so we're seeing quite a few of these. Well, in this case, it's a poem. But what I like is that because it's posted like this, people are able to post their responses and what they think about what they've seen. And so it's not simply the act of expressing the story. They're also getting, if you will, a validation of what they've written, that their experience is real and it has been seen by other people.
And I think that's something that's kind of crucial, again, in an educational setting. I hate to sort of always sort of divert to the video conference kind of setting, but what within the whole area of feedback, we as teachers think of feedback as something that is pertaining to course content. We said, yes, little Johnny, you did real well here, you can improve here, and that sort of thing. But I think we as teachers in a face-to-face setting provide a lot of social feedback in acknowledging, simply acknowledging our students.
Yeah.
And identifying their presence and welcoming them and that sort of thing. It is kind of hard to do in a mediated setting. Even if you think of submitting an assignment,
right.
In a regular classroom, you can take your paper up and you can give it to the teacher, and that teacher usually says, thanks, Billy, or whatever it happens to be. There's the acknowledgement that, yes, this transaction has taken place. That, yes, the teacher has my assignment. With using email or using, like our multifunction printers that are connected over the IP lines to submit assignments, I go up and I stick it into that feeder, it goes through and I have it back, and you just sort of sit there and pray that somewhere along the line that, the instructor has received it.
If you're lucky, you'll get a beep.
So I think we need to sort of look at the acknowledgement feedback kind of
mechanism. It's not just acknowledgement either. A lot of times people think of when students are in these virtual spaces and they're going, if you will, off topic or whatever, but it's this off topic stuff that establishes an identity and a presence for the student in a remote area. If you're searching around on Google, you should look up Terry Anderson, who works with Athabasca University on social presence in an online environment. Because this is very important, because it's the presence that actually lends a context and a meaning to the communication that's taking place. Knowing where somebody is coming from actually tells you what the words that they're using mean. And if you don't have that, now what you're doing is you're reading their text through your life and your interpretation, and of course you're reading it very differently than what they wrote. But if you understand who they are, what their background is, what sorts of stories they tell about their dog or their father or their backyard or whatever, not just to you but also to their friends, then you're getting a whole picture of them, so that when you read something that they've written, some work that they've handed in, you know that this piece of work is coming from this background and therefore says such and such, and it might be something very different than you would mean by the very same words were you writing it. So it's important to have the stories and the personal things as part of the communication in an online environment. So does anyone have any stories? just we had dead air there.
You know, just to throw in, you talk about Terry Anderson and his work with that group on you know, social presence and cognitive presence and teaching presence,
right,
and whatnot. There is also an article by Lombard and Ditton that deals with the whole area of researching various types of social presence as well. That, is worth looking at.
Lombard and Ditton. Ditton. Just see if it shows up on Google. Lombard, Ditton, et al., Measuring Presence, a literature-based, probably not it.
Okay, the next one down.
Next one down.
Yeah, at the heart of it.
At the heart of it all, the concept of presence.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're not going to get the whole article here because it's owned by publishers who don't share, which makes me very annoyed. But I will say that it's in the Journal of Computer Mediated Communication, who should be publishing in open access, but don't. And this is why, right? We've got a room full of educators who could use this text now, and we can't get to it. And that's the net broken. That's a system that's not working.
And well, I've got a copy of it if anybody wants it.
Yeah. But anyhow, there it is. So, but we can't really go into it. If you've ever read my website, Matt, you know I go off on this tangent on a regular basis because I think it's a big issue. Just the being able to access this material online, because if you can't access it, from my perspective, it might as well not be there. It's that old saying, right? If you can't find it on Google, it doesn't exist.
It can't be that old, so.
Pardon?
That saying can't be that old. Maybe a couple of years.
Oh, no, it was what, from 2000? Or this one is, 1997. There's no reason for that not to be online. There's none whatsoever, in my view. So, but at least this other article is online. Oh, no, that's an abstract, too. So, yeah. All kinds of stuff by Lombard and Ditton. I'll have to follow this up because I'm not familiar with them myself. So, see, you learn something. You come out here to Edson and you're doing stuff and you're still learning. Okay, what else? Examples. Here's more storytelling and stuff. Blog, right? And here the see, look at this JHH third grade blogs. If you're thinking people are too young for some of this stuff, the buzz in Ms. Rickard's class. Jesse was named December Student of the Month, and there's Jesse. Nice
right
big.
There's fourth, right?
Yeah. Right. Right there. Well, there's one. It's just that's the next three pictures of the form.
So, I wonder how Jesse feels about that. You know, There it is, a nice big picture, December student of the month in Mrs. Ms. Rickard's class.
Found
you found
it?
Oh, cool. Great. Can you send it to me? Thank you. So, this is interesting. Can you imagine how you would feel if you were a turkey and Thanksgiving were approaching? There's November student of the month. Same backdrop. So I like stuff like this. I can sit here and look at this stuff all day. But I guess we really do need to move on. But again, you're just sort of seeing ways where you can draw out certain aspects or certain elements of the class. Putting them on a blog like this, on your teacher's blog, highlights them. It's like underlining them or using yellow highlighter or whatever.
And again, I think we do have to sort of recognize whether we do this internally, say within a division, or whether we're putting this up on the, you know, the big bad internet kind of thing.
Well, that's right. I mean, you don't put up a 2 megabyte image of a student on a public website without some clear permission to do so.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know,
we were just saying it's not fine. It almost doesn't matter what the kid thinks about it, because the kid's not old enough. His child is not old enough to make that judgment call.
Mm-hmm.
Can't possibly comprehend all the
implications. That's right.
And
so
most of the white kinds of documents and permissions that we get, you know, if the kid is under 18, you know, we need parent permission as well. So
unfortunately, a lot of them don't understand the implications of it.
Which means you need to understand the implications. And then also, and equally importantly, be able to communicate those implications in some manner to the parents.
But those people sign off on those forms. They come to my school, they walk in, I would like to register my child. That's great, give me all your personal information and sign these 5 forms, and the secretary telling them.
Yep.
And basically their thing is, if they get onto the wrong spot on the internet, they promise to back up, tell a teacher and say, this is what I did, and just so that they know.
Yep.
They don't say anything about personal, none of that other stuff. Like, would you please have this form? So if we want to take a picture of your child, we can post it around the school, on our school website or wherever else.
But until, precedence is set, until the day that someone stands in front of the judge, and the judge says, the judge is going to sit there and say, you know what, that parent didn't know what they were signing.
Yep.
They signed there with your good faith because you're a teacher and you're telling them they trusted you, and I don't care what they signed. Maybe. You know what I mean? So, protection is going to give you
anything? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
These 2 days prove how many different forms this is all going to take.
Yeah.
And most parents still think you walk in, I use the internet, I do a search, I get the information, I copy it down, I go back to my classroom, and I write it out in some form and hand it to the teacher.
Yeah.
When really, that's not a very interactive web experience.
No, and that's the big change that the web has undergone in the last few years.
Yeah.
From this broadcast medium to this place where you do things. It's a huge change, and people don't understand the implications of this change. And you know, like they call it Web 2.0, people go sort of go, oh yeah, just another fad, blah blah blah, you know, marketing, blah blah blah. But there is a fundamental change that has happened, and the web that we knew isn't the web that's out there anymore. It really has changed.
And maybe we should, you know, initiate a discussion here about how we as teachers are going to adjust to that.
Yeah. How are we going to? It's not a responsibility to set way.
No. But it's also education's got to start in our own classrooms with our own teachers first, because half of them, let's say half of them have good computer skills. More than half have good computer skills. But many of those same people, still don't get what we're getting here. And they don't have a clue what it is that their kids can do. Watching Oprah once and seeing about the kid who was abducted is one thing. They don't see where it is and how easy it is to do. Teachers, parents got to be educated, administrators as well, who are watching over.
Yep. Podcasts for teachers. This is more in the area of professional development. It's coming from Fordham University, which is, I don't know, off in the Bronx. That's the neat thing, too. You get stuff from everywhere. And basically, there's just a regular series of podcasts that teachers can listen to for their own professional development. And it's as easy as clicking on the link, and we'll wait for a couple seconds here for the MP3 file to download. And up pops a little QuickTime icon thingy.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 21, January 16th, 2006. www.podcastforteachers.org. More ed tech you can use today and tomorrow. In this episode, we present Youth Culture and Education, Diverge or Converge, Web 2.0, and a guest interview with Seamus King. Join in the conversation of ed tech you can use.
Now imagine people can just listen to this on their lunch hour. Or in their car.
And sitting with me is Dr. Kathy King.
So, we could probably spend the next hour listening to that, and it would be really good content, but we won't, because it's sitting here online. You have the link, and you can go back to it this evening or whatever. And again, if you have an iPod or a Creative Zen or an iRiver or one of those things, just download it onto your player, and if you go out for your morning run or your drive to work or whatever, you're listening to that.
And I know that's one of the discussions that I've had with a couple people, with the area of professional development. Do we continue with the sort of pull-out model that we've been using, like we're using right now, or how do we have the ability to integrate it into their daily lives and sort of bring in a little bit more of this anytime, anywhere for adult kind of access to
that's professional development for kids, right?
Sure.
Right now, there's how many kids across the division who are possibly missing out on having a teacher in front of them that's got that particular skill set.
Yeah.
But on the other side, how are you ever going to sell that to teachers? Because at least when you pull them out, you say, it's important, you think it's important, give me the time.
Maybe what you do is you pull them out less, is the thing.
Right.
We're going to pull you out the first time.
Yeah.
We're going to show you some of that stuff, and then we're going to build this into your time, so that if you have PLCs or professional learning communities, your PLC gets together, listens to this, does whatever that goes along with it, you do it in your embedded date, that might be a way to make it go. You still have to have probably some pull-out, but hopefully less than what you were doing before, where you're pulling up for every single thing.
Yeah, that's what I found in my own work, is that the learning has to be embedded right into the thing that I'm doing. And for me, the most valuable professional development that I ever engaged in was to start doing my newsletter. And I started doing my newsletter simply as a way to record my bookmarks, but then people started reading it, so it sort of changed its character. But the thing is, now I spend an hour or 2 hours a day doing this newsletter, and I do it every day, but now what that means is I'm doing this amount of time of very focused research every day, well, every work day, because I take weekends off. And so I get more out of the newsletter than any reader ever possibly would. Now, I know teachers don't have 2 hours a day to do a newsletter, and the world probably doesn't need that many newsletters in any case. But again, just inserting something as a regular practice, as part of your regular work that you do, is really important. And if I were a teacher in a classroom, what I'd be trying to do is find some mechanism within the classroom environment itself that acts as a teaching experience for me, along with a teaching experience for the students, and to be a co-learner with the students in some fashion. And if you can find sources of information that you can trust, like some of these podcasts, and of course, you preview them and make sure that, whatever comes up is going to be good things, then you can use these pieces of this kind of content in the class to educate yourself as well as the students. I think that would be useful. But again, it's the embedding that's important. because everybody thinks of learning something that they go off and do in a room, well, like this, but really it's the day-to-day stuff that's the most important of all.
And it's having access to time to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I hear from our teachers on a regular basis is, you know, it's all well and nice to have the pullouts and bring people in and that sort of thing. What we need is the time to sit and negotiate in our minds what it is that is going to be useful out of this. And the writing process, as you said, you know, helps structure in your mind your view of what it is, your topic of the day or whatever.
The writing is key for me. Yeah. That's where I actually do the learning. So now there's a whole bunch of archives for this site. So you've got several weeks of listening right here. But this is the sort of thing. I was just thinking about this. How many of you, and both here and the other two sites, how many of you own or have on a daily basis an iPod or equivalent? One, two, a bunch of people in Wolf Creek. Looks like everyone in Wolf Creek. What's your secret there? Why do you all have them and they don't hear?
The comment was that we're all active, we're runners, we do things like that.
Okay, well, yeah.
And maybe we could throw this out to talk a little bit about the area of professional development and embedding and that sort of thing and the role that, you know, podcasts might play within that. Is this a road that we should pursue? You're talking to the wrong guy.
Or at least
the
membership.
Yeah.
If you could get these things with, like, and it must be almost there, like an iPod or a memory stick, isn't it?
He's selling his identity badge.
Everybody where it
Well, you said professional development, so that, you know, that's something that your employer would have to provide for
Yeah.
I think the thing with time, though, like, I don't know, like everyone's busy and stuff, the thing that I think as a commodity, an absolute commodity, what we could do a lot better at is making people accountable. Because what I see is that there's lots of good PD, but I think there's lots of times that we don't use the time as efficiently as we could.
Right.
Yeah. So I think if we had some structure that we could, like, have more accountability, then we'd get more efficient use of our time.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that people deliberately waste time.
Well, I know some.
I think I don't think there's enough accountability to do it.
You know, some professions actually do mandate a certain number of hours of professional development and leave it up to the individual to report it on an annual basis. My wife is a nurse in the nursing profession, does it on those lines. There's all kinds of stuff that is provided, but you have like a smorgasbord choice of what it is that you want to do, and maybe that's a route that we could pursue. You know, and again, I think the concern I have comes back to the mandating.
I was sort of grumbling here about the same thing.
You know,
some stuff already is mandated, though, eh, Gordon? Like, schools have mandated so many days they have to devote, which is so many hours, to professional development.
Yeah.
They have to do that. How you do it and how you organize it off Fridays, after school, whatever it happens to be, it's kind of up to individual sites, but those things are mandated. And then you have a professional growth plan, which is linked to that, which is you're accountable to your professional growth plan. If you don't follow that and have things that are related to it, then you're... So there is some accountability. No, I don't know if there has been a what happens if you don't do it. I guess you get in trouble with the principal, or
take
you over to head, or...
The strap.
The strap. Yeah, right back to discipline. That's it.
It comes down to the difference between being mandated and having an opportunity. You know, and I use the phrase a couple of times here, you know, linking those two together and saying, you know, providing a mandated opportunity. Which sort of ranks right up there with Jumbo Shrimp and, you know, Canada Post Service.
Crash landing.
You know, crash landing, you know. But I think, you know,
we do have maybe sort of the structure, but maybe not the the techniques to
I think you need a combination of things too. Some stuff has to come from central office. Some stuff has to come from locally developed school ideas. Some stuff has to come from the individuals. So if you have lots of different things that are out there, then things work out well. But you definitely need, there's got to be some sort of top-down organization of some of it anyways. Not necessarily all of it. I don't want everything rammed at me. Although you have to do these 17 things, I'd like to pick at least four of my own. And, you know,
Or you mandate four opportunities or four events or whatever it happens to your activity.
And then take those things and work for your school or for yourself or whatever.
And then you only provide four.
But going back to Stephen's point about you've got to want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, he enjoys doing his newsletter, so he gets a lot out of it.
Right.
Similarly, like, we just happen to sit down and talk at this thing about GPS.
Right.
So we'll probably go off, let me talk about database, right? So then we'll have to do that, right? So, there's lots of, so from just being in this room for 2 days, there's going to be lots of other spin-offs that had nothing to do with this.
Right.
So you cut to the benefits of just sitting down, and you would get those from Stephen, maybe. But, you know, the real good stuff is all the aside conversations that, you know, why are you getting your coffee? Hey, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it.
Well, thanks. Oh, no, but you're absolutely right, which is why, like, they're off doing Telnet over there. I'm thinking, great. Because they're getting value out of their time. And we're providing, you know, some good, it's like background radio. And I don't have a problem with that. The thing with mandating is because mandating, you know, there's always the tendency to move from... from what to how, right? And you know, they would say, you know, instead of you need to learn such and such, they will say, you need to listen to this podcast or you need to take this course. And so the more mandating there is, the less effective the learning tends to become. I mean, I was just thinking as this discussion was going on, imagine that you were mandated to listen to these podcasts on this website. And think about how active a listener you would be if you were listening to them because you had to, as opposed to because you wanted to. And so my own predisposition is always toward what's generally called learner-centered learning or learner-driven learning, to the point even of having the learners select what they learn. I think this is especially the case in adult education or professional development because, you know, this is you that you're developing, right? And you don't belong to the school division. These are your skills and your capacities and your marketability. And my perception is, and not everybody agrees with this, but my perception is, right, I don't want them telling me what I will be because that's my right. Identity is very important. And now for the rebuttal.
I think there's a balance between a system level definition of what happens and a teacher only definition of what happens. There is a contract of employment here. And the contract of employment is providing educational services to our clients called parents, students, and community members. And within that contract, we have an educational plan and a set of outcomes and a set of activities that we fund. And part of those funded activities are release time. Kurt brought it up a while ago and everything else. And we have a pretty clear expectation that professional growth must be aligned to where the system's going, where the main areas of focus of the school's going, and that the teachers slot into that. Now, there's still quite a range there, and I believe it's a balance between. We have had what you described, do whatever the heck you want for a decade, and we know where it took us. It took us all over the map, and it was very problematic.
So you always balance between priorities, and somebody, you can't do everything.
Gord talked about the medical profession.
Right.
And there's a set of activities that you can choose from within that fits within that contract of employment. And it still has to be within, why are you here? What's your role in providing educational services to students in a publicly funded educational system? We're not going to say that everybody has to do a blog, right?
And we're not going to say that everybody has to go to Percival's web stuff after a while here either. Right? But for those who want to, it's an element of choice. But those choice elements have to be mapped clearly into our planning cycle of where we're going.
Maybe we could call on Wolf Creek and Black Gold to talk a little bit about their perspective on professional development here.
And you are required to answer.
Well, in Black Gold, we certainly do involve our teachers in a lot of professional development, and it's a real priority for us. And there is choice involved. However, I agree with John that really what are schools about? Schools are about kids, and we need to make sure that our teachers are doing good things with kids. And if they need some help in that area, it would seem to me we have a responsibility to make a situation where they will get the help that they need. And again, some people are not as interested as others, but certainly I found if you keep trying to help them, it's pretty hard to say no to help.
Right.
Comments, Gary?
Thanks, Bert. The comments would probably follow along the same lines as John and Peter have already reiterated. I mean, we're here to some extent that the good graces of the Minister of Education, if I want to take it to an extreme, in the sense that we have a mandate to deliver the Alberta Program of Studies, and that's what the taxpayers are giving us the money to do. John described the world of go out and do your own thing, and he's right. You know, like that probably didn't get us as far down the road as we would like to have gone in terms of achieving the outcomes that we're mandated to achieve. In Wolf Creek now, we have refocused a lot of our efforts and resources around the vision for the school jurisdiction, and in particular, we're focusing a lot of our PD efforts around assessment and effectively assessing the outcomes of our efforts. And I don't mean assessment in the sense of provincial achievement tests. I mean a much more holistic approach of assessment for learning as opposed to assessment of learning. So a lot of our professional learning communities are tying their activities now towards an assessment focus to assess what we're doing and is it effective and adjust the instructional practice such that it does become more effective. And in that sense, assessment for learning as opposed to assessment of learning, which would be provincial achievement tests, for example. So yeah, I think that we have limited resources and we want to focus those resources. We certainly believe very strongly in professional development, but let's focus that professional development around achieving what our mission is here. Bruce, did you want to comment?
Bruce, not after that.
The next line was supposed to be, but I'll throw this in.
I'm coming from the background of a classroom teacher, as most of us are of that background, if not all of us. As individuals, we appreciate the opportunities to be able to pursue our individual professional development, and sometimes we take exception to being told what direction we want to go in professional development, but there are individual goals, and there are goals for the jurisdiction, there are goals for our province, and goals for education, so we have to consider those things when we are dealing with aligning those goals and making progress, start making progress in any one area. If we're spread too far in too many different areas.
I think what it, you know, as you were speaking there, I think we have to clearly delineate the difference between professional development and personal development.
And I don't think that, you know, they not necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. And there are areas there that of overlap, and perhaps, you know, what John was alluding to here a while back was that, you know, we were looking at that overlap area, but it was starting to spill over into, you know, something that was not related to, you know, the assignment or the job that was that we were being hired to do.
But we can even extend that to another group of individuals in this room right now. We've got four of our technicians here, which I don't think you would find in many other situations where we're doing something like this, where the support staff's here at the same time. But when we go into new technology initiatives, it's very clear and structured what we have to do, because it's a nuts and bolts kind of issue around it. Let's see. Wow, tell us what it's like. What's professional growth like within a technical area of support, teaching and learning?
It's a lot of home study.
Yeah.
You know, we get to do as much training as we can on the job. We learn how to go a lot of times. A lot of home study.
Research.
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 Yeah.
That's what we were saying over here about, almost by definition, like, the people who have chosen to give their time today or made this a priority are a particular personality type. So within our division, you'll get people who are prepared to put the time in at home, and they might be a technician, or they might be a teacher, or they might be an administrator, but there's going to be, like, certain people will do the extra stuff because that's the kind of person they are. They're engaged, they're active, they embrace new technologies, whatever. Mm-hmm. But without direction from the division, the other, like, colleagues that we have, they need, like, they wouldn't do anything. If they weren't directed, they wouldn't do anything.
Doesn't that point to a wider problem? I mean, here we have professionals working in the community teaching our children who, as you just said, if they weren't directed, wouldn't do anything. And then that tells me that maybe there's something that needs to be addressed at some point in their earlier education, so that when they get into these positions, you don't need to tell them what to do. They can figure it out for themselves. I mean, these are products of our university system.
But is that an educational thing, or is that just a personality? I think it's a personality.
It's a personality.
I think that some people, I think it's more to do with the personality type. It's not that they can't learn.
But, I mean, people aren't born like, gee, I'm not going to do anything unless I'm told. I mean, they're not born that way. There's a process that they go through that results in them being that way.
And the interest level.
We're all sitting here doing technology stuff, and I know three teachers in my school that would say, instead of doing this part of the technology, I would rather focus on Betty Weave's style instruction. You can send me to 5 days of that, and I'll soak it up, and I'll be awesome, and I'll do great work with it. I just don't know if I can make the two compatible. I need somebody maybe to help me, but right now my interest lies in this. Or what if I really need to have first aid as my big thing to make it better for me? Or me as an assistant principal, I need to go and say, I've done lots of technology for a while. Now I need to know how to do these things that fit my portfolio for administration.
Right.
So I think there's some that I know teachers that find a way to get out of every professional development thing that there is.
But
school, division mandate, and I know others that are the opposite.
We have a much more formalized process than that. That's been undertaken for 2.5 years in Grand Yellowhead.
Absolutely.
We have outcomes for schools.
Yeah.
We have a school review process. A school follows a continuous improvement plan.
Yeah.
They identify their greatest area of needs based on external measures from Alberta Education. And then as staff members look at strengths, accomplishments, challenges, and then the challenges section, the tools or strategies that we are aligning right now would be professional growth. So I'm going to pick on your school in specific.
Sure.
Before we went into a data analysis model at Crescent Valley School, every kid was at least one or two grade levels below grade level on reading.
There was definitely a lot. Yeah.
Absolutely. So then what do we say collectively between the superintendency staff and the principals and the administration of the school? We've got a bit of a problem. Those children should be at grade level. Most of them, right, to the norm. How are you going to get there? So right Now, what would be the focus of professional growth? Because you have only so much time. We're talking about it. We have only so many dollars. Right? And we saw a huge turnaround in your school in 1 year because it became an area of focus for staff members. And they said, all right, we're here to do the job. We can do the job. Turn it around in less than a year.
Yeah, no, I agree.
There, and that's when we're talking about the balance between the system level perspective of what has to happen within professional growth versus the very personal level of what people want to do within professional growth.
And it's difficult for the teacher or the in the trenches, right? To like, it's probably easier for you guys here to see that as a priority sometimes. You know what I mean? Like,
well,
you need someone who's a step removed to
it's
say.
It's only because we're all coming from a data-driven analysis as to what we're doing. Gary talked about achieving the outcomes defined within the program of studies. If everybody was achieving the outcomes within the program of studies up to what we would accept as a base level, there'd be a wider latitude in choice as to where we go next. But when there are issues within schools that you can pick out and focus on, that's where we have to get. That's where even the supervision and the evaluation models begin to come in, because somewhere through this we have a policy, right, that came out of Alberta, professional growth, supervision, evaluation, right? What's professional growth for? To get teachers to where they need to be, and support staff members. What's the supervision about?
Making sure they're doing it.
What's the evaluation about? Calling the spade a spade.
And if they're not doing it, how can we go to help until we get to the point of doing it on a kind of manner?
So. So
yeah,
you
really
opened
up a can of worms. That's why I'm here.
And I think to sort of follow up on that, I think if it's, it is sort of observed, it's measurable, needs are identified, and those needs become incorporated in part of the responsibility and the job description for the teacher.
Sure.
But as you said a second ago, we're looking at situations in which, you have individual staff members that, will do everything that they possibly can to get out of doing, any kind of...
Especially external stuff. When you embed it, those same teachers that might be doing that, you embed PLC, professional learning community time, watching go to it. Those same people that were refused to do it on an off-ride, do it at nighttime, miss a staff meeting, do all those things, I watched all those people. So when James said about it's harder when you're in the trenches, the way that we made it easier, the way it was made easier for us was by creating embedded PLC time. And that was an administrative decision of the school for us to cover more stuff so the teachers could meet during the daytime, run back-to-back preps, all those things so people are in there. And that was the one, like John said about the turnaround, that's one way that really turned things around. I'm hooked on this particular thing. What do you do? Oh, cool. I'll try that. And then let's make some models. Let's make some common assessments. Let's do all these things.
And the next one after that is going to be getting those PLCs, because there's lots of small schools and they're spread out.
But right.
There's lots of teachers who are the only teacher we have, like the long master.
Evansburg only has one grade 6 teacher.
You know what I mean? So once you can ever coordinate that, so that you can use the 3D technology to have PLC within another school like the office.
And if you can do it embedded, so it's embedded, so that takes a lot of organization, but you do some times where you can embed a grade 6 teacher from each school during their own daytime, running a similar cycle. Yeah.
Scheduling
is always a
thing. I think it's worth pursuing.
Absolutely.
So that was podcasting. still on the same subject, and I just sort of mentioned this a little bit earlier on, related to podcasting. This is EdTech Posse. Four of your colleagues, four people who are basically doing the same thing that you guys are doing, except they're based in Saskatchewan, so they don't have as much money. I'm just kidding. What they've done is they've set up a regular EdTech podcast, and as you can see, they chat with me a fair bit. One of the next ones will involve the discussion we had the other day. And it's very simple what they do. They do two things. One of them has purchased an iRiver, They bought an iRiver because it uses the MP3 plus it has the line in.
Yeah, you can record off of anything.
You can record off of anything. Me.
It just records whatever you. It just records whatever you want. Kind of like what you're doing right now about Acid. You just plug it into whatever source you have that has a line up, and then my little 512 meg MP3 player
will
take whatever and convert it to audio for you.
Under Canadian law, it's legal, but don't do it in the States.
What about the radio? I don't know. It's personal use.
I mean, at least there are levies applied now, not to these particular players, but to most audio media, most audio recording media. There are levies charged by and paid to the publishers for the music that you will at some point record on these devices. You have already paid for this under Canadian law. The exception is these personal MP3 players, and there was an application made for those to be covered under the same legislation, but that was turned down. That was about a year ago. My expectation is that these players will eventually be covered under that same thing, and we'll pay the copyright levy for that. But CDs, audio tape, any of these media that you buy, you're paying a levy, a royalty, on music that you haven't put there yet, but you will one day.
Apple has to reimburse levies if they take them for that.
Right.
And iRiver also has two parts built into it. What you record off of the iRiver, you can transfer to another computer. What you get as an MP3 off of the internet, you cannot. The player simply will not allow you to transfer. It's built in as a, whatever, however they block it, it's built into the player. And it's labeled very clearly on the website. You can do this, but you cannot do that. Whereas Creative and others, you pull that little USB stick out, you stick it in somewhere else, and you can break copyright all over the place.
And that's why I got the Creative. Instead of the iRiver, but now I'm sitting there with the Creative. It doesn't have the line in jack, so I need two of them.
It doesn't have the same sound.
So anyhow, what these guys do, they're like you. They're spread all over the province. They're in three or four different cities: Regina, Saskatoon, Moose Jaw, and so they use Skype. And here's Skype. How many of you have heard of Skype? Here's Skype, and as the slogan says, with Skype you can talk to anyone, anywhere for free, forever. The forever, I think, was added after, who was it, eBay bought them? Either eBay or Amazon, I forget which. Basically, Skype is online audio conferencing, and they've just introduced last November Skype 2.0 beta version, which also incorporates video conferencing. And I use Skype. I use Skype quite a bit. It's an easy download, easy install, and it will work through your firewalls and all of that because it spoofs port 80 is what it does. So it kind of sneaks through. There have been some discussions about security issues related to Skype because it is proprietary. Especially on the technical side of the house, if you have Skype installed, you want to be watching for that, do some packet checking, make sure it's not doing stuff you don't want it to be doing. Just keep an eye on it. There haven't been any reported incidents yet, but the concern is there is that capacity. There is open source audio conferencing software like this in development. It's not ready for prime time yet. Skype is. With Skype, the sound quality is just spectacular. And I was foolish and didn't ask for an installation because I just didn't think of it back when we were scheduling it. I do have it on my laptop here. So, it's just I wanted to put it up on the smart board. So, but yeah, you can install it on the fly if you want while I'm talking.
You can just
lick your own. I can just do it here.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, this will be an easy install. Okay. Bloody, you know, I have to find it. Yeah, that's good. See, you can see the reaction to some of these issues, right? No spyware, adware, malware. And we believe this. And we'll save it somewhere. And 9.5 meg, and I guess everybody's downloading it. But the thing with Skype, too, is like it does audio conferencing, but it also has a chat feature, so you can do the instant messaging as well. And it gets used as much for that as for audio conferencing. So what the EdTech posse did, they got their iRiver, and they've all got their Skype. So every Thursday or whatever, they just get together in Skype. You can have a conference with the free version, up to 4 people at once in a conference. And so they just all get together at a conference, they chat, and one person line out to their iRiver, and they record the podcast. So now they've got their MP3 file. They load their MP3 file into Audacity and clean it up a bit. I always skip that step because I'm lazy. And then they upload it as a podcast the way I described it yesterday. And as it turns out, this is pretty popular. These guys have several hundred listeners. And if you listen to it, they're just a bunch of ed tech people talking about their day. But it turns out that that's really useful. And that's why I'm recording this. I've been recording since yesterday morning. I'll be recording till we're done, because you might think, oh, yeah, I'm about to post, 10, 12 hours of audio. You might, who's going to listen to that? Somebody is listening to that. They're listening to these very words that I'm speaking right now. And they will have listened to the 8 hours that preceded it and found it enormously useful, because the content that we're generating here is stuff that's simply inaccessible to them. I mean, there will be people in Botswana or in Mumbai or places like that that will wait the week for this thing to download in order to listen to this discussion, because this kind of discussion is something they could never get otherwise.
And maybe one thing that I'll throw in here to sort of prime the pump for the end of the day here, I want to take a look at the end of the day sort of saying, where do we go as a group from here? And take a look at, I don't know if we want to talk a little bit about the idea of, inter-jurisdictional PLCs or something like that with, the people that are participating in this kind of an event. Or whatnot, but this might be a tool that might facilitate that. I'm just sort of priming the pump for the end of the day here, and if we could sort of think along the lines of where we want to go from here, and think of that as we're looking at some of these tools, then I appreciate it.
We did work in Alberta. When I was at the University of Alberta with the Faculty of Extension, working with municipal administrators and that throughout the province here. And we did some survey work on how they conduct their own professional development. And what we found by a wide margin is that when they needed to learn something related to their work, the first thing they were going to do is pick up the phone and call somebody that they knew. But they had all this internet access. We put a whole library of resources. They had everything. $1 million project, and they'd pick up the phone. And you just sort of go. And what something like Skype does is it puts the phone on your computer, and now it's ringing. Isn't that? That's pretty interesting. Okay, let's try to pull out of that. That's like Twilight Zone. Okay, well, we now know that there are issues with Bridget software and Skype installation. So, this, okay, So anyhow, that the are you sure you want to? They're sort of
which
going,
one?
Yes,
yeah.
Please. So, but the thing is, when you're not conferencing with Bridget, you have all the list of your contacts just sitting there, and it's like a right click and you're chatting with them, and you're either like text chatting, which is what I prefer, because you don't want to interrupt them necessarily with a phone call. And Skype protocol is you chat, is it okay if I call you, and then you actually make the audio call. And it's right there, you don't even need to leave your computer screen. And for cost conscious people, it's free. And you're calling from here to Lethbridge. How much did it cost the board? $0. 0 cents. And I chat with people all over the world, and it just doesn't cost me anything. And then it can be recorded and become part of this archive of content that people can tap into and listen to.
One point of clarification here. Prior to June, we wouldn't have even considered this, given some of the very low bandwidth connections off the internet through here to schools.
Sure.
But now that you're on a broadband network with 30 megs in, and then 20 to your schools,
you're laughing.
It's doable. I think the internet performance is probably okay right now. How is it through your experience? Your internet access right now?
Here, right now, it's okay. I've had a couple of sites that have been slow, but that might have been the remote sites as well. But we seem to be doing all right. My site's just popping up, and that's of course my baseline reference. So, basically, what I've got here feels equivalent to what I've got in my home. And usually, when I'm in a workplace, it's a lot less than what I've got in my home. So I think we're doing well. I have cable internet in my home. I wouldn't live without it.
How's with the voice thing on that? Like, what's the performance like on that? I mean, my own experience with something comparable was the Yahoo thing with the Logitech webcam a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And it was terrible.
Yeah.
Like, the resolution was low. I mean, I know, it was also quick, but there was low resolution, small images, and you couldn't, the voice thing wasn't practical, just the text thing.
I'm not able to evaluate the Skype video yet. The Skype audio does depend on the connectivity. But when you have the bandwidth, and these days most people have the bandwidth, the audio quality is excellent. Better than a phone.
What about the delay?
You don't, reverb isn't the right way.
You don't have your volume turned up too high or too close to your mic, you're fine. If you've got your volume, your speakers are right next to your mic, and you've got your speakers turned up loud, there is reverb. But my mother is very hard of hearing, and I speak to her all the time in camera. They've got high speed, I've got high speed.
Who bought Skype? Either eBay or Amazon, one or the other.
Then they're going to make a commercial service, right?
No, well, it is.
But there's another one. What's the other one?
I've forgotten the name offhand. Anyhow, I'm sort of mumbling here because we've hit the 12 o'clock mark, which means there's food, possibly of the hot variety, sitting there waiting for us.
So maybe if we could break at this point, and maybe we'll just leave the video conference connections up, and if we could just mute each site, I assume that's what we did yesterday.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And we'll meet back here at 1.
And for those of you who are listening to the audio recording, this is the end of Edson Tape 3, and we'll start up again after lunch on Edson Tape 4.